finally a good romantic comedy going on in there, and you look at some of those, and so there's some positive stories. And all of a sudden you realize that these aren't stories. It's real life. This is how life is, right? You got some really sad things that happen, some really bad things that happen, and you got some good things that happen. You got people that are good people, and they make mistakes, and then they recover from those mistakes, and you realize it's real. And that's one of the bigger proofs to me, when I look through all these, of that these are not stories. These are not Bible stories. These are records of real people that lived and how they interacted with their Creator that God wants us to look at and learn lessons from. And perhaps one of the biggest lessons is when we look at all the sadness, we realize we need some good news. It really points to Christ, right? Like, we need somebody, something to solve this big problem that we got, this problem of sin and just making a lot of mistakes. How do we solve that? It points to Christ and the fact that we need good news. So that's one impression. Another one is I like looking at time. I like time is interesting to me. When Jeff talks about, like, the dates that Nebuchadnezzar did things, I'm like, this is really cool. So, sorry, you're going to have to deal with a little time. This is a rough timeline of what we've been studying. And you get different scholars that think different things. But roughly, Judges is about 400 years. Think about it, that's a long time, right? And then the United Kingdom was probably around 120. And you got Israel lasting for maybe another 200 and Judah another 350 after that. And I want to put this in perspective. When did Christopher Columbus discover the New World? What was that date? Anybody remember? 1492. I heard it over here somewhere too, right? 1492. So if you think about it, it was a little over 500 years ago. That's roughly the period of time we've been talking about. Doesn't that kind of put it in perspective? Sometimes we think, like, wow, these guys just mess up a lot. We're talking about a long period of time, right? And then think about it. Our United States has only been around for, what, about 250 years? The whole period of the Judges was longer than that. So to me, that's a little perspective, right? And sometimes we get depressed about our nation. How long has it been since the 60s? Right? Was that 50-something years, right? I would say that probably is the time when our nation is going through its current decline, when that really started. I'm sorry, guys. I'm blaming it on all you people that are back in the 60s. But I think that's a pretty accurate assessment in our culture, is that the 60s marked a kind of a big turning point in how people thought about things in our country. And we are seeing the effects of that. Well, that's just like one cycle in the Judges, if you think of it that way. So maybe a little perspective there. Okay, another general impression. False gods come up a lot, right? One of the young ones, what is a false god? There you go, a type of idol, right? It's something that a person made, right? Some man said, hey, here's my God, I'm going to worship him, right? All right, so for some of the older ones, why do people worship false gods? I'll take a young one. Go ahead. So they don't think the real God's real. They don't have a belief in the real God. Why else would they worship a false god? Sully? There you go. You can make that false god whatever you want it to be, right? So, but the good news is in our culture, we don't have false gods, right? Like, that's a thing of the past. All right, what are some false gods that we have now? What's that? Anything that you worship. What do we worship, Gloria, that's not the real God in our culture? Yep, your job. Money, beauty, health. What else? What's that? Hollywood. There you go. So if you put these things together, right, you know, we mentioned a false god is not the real God, so it doesn't have any power, right? Go ahead, Cheryl. Right. Yeah, the melting pot in America has changed over the last 30 years, right? We have had an influx of other cultures that don't believe in the one true God. That's true. So you see a couple different things going on. You see the nations around Israel, and they worship Molech and Dagon. We'll talk about Dagon today, and Baal and Ashtaroth, and that's a temptation to the Israelites. But I think that in our culture, we also have a different temptation, which is to say we worship the real God, but do what Sullied is, and we want to make that real God what we want him to be. We want his morals to be whatever the morals of the culture is around us, and we're going to see that today. We'll see that happening. Go ahead, Herbert. Role models. Go ahead, Brian. Yeah. We think maybe that God wants us to be happy when what the Bible teaches us is that God wants us to be holy, right? That's the difference. And you think about it, in Judges, everyone did what was right, right? Everyone did what was right in their own eyes, right? And we had the same kind of problems today. So that's one thing that stood out, and that's going to come up today too. Okay, here's another thing that stood out. I don't know that I've ever really thought about this phrase, but this phrase shows up a lot. The phrase that they were worthless men shows up several times. It showed up in Deuteronomy to talk about men that would seduce the people to worship false gods. They were called worthless men. Another one was Abimelech's men. Remember when, for the young ones, who was Abimelech? A judge, kind of. Who was his father? Anybody remember? Remember who Abimelech's father was? Gideon, thank you. Gideon was his father, and so he felt like he had a right to be the king. So he hired a whole bunch of mercenaries, a bunch of worthless men, to help him secure his position, right? How about, remember the story that David talked about? The Benjamites and this Levite concubine, probably one of the worst times in the whole history. It's just terrible. They were called worthless men. In a little bit, next lesson, we'll learn about the men who didn't support Saul becoming a king. They called them worthless men. There were some other worthless men that we're going to talk about today. So if you remember, Billy talked about where the people worshiped God at this time. It was at the tabernacle, and it was at Shiloh. Who were the priests at this time? Jonathan raised his hand. He gave a signal. It's kind of like, you know, when you're in an auction and you do something. Who were the priests at this time? Yeah, Eli and his sons Hophni and Phinehas. And what kind of guys were Hophni and Phinehas? Bad. Yep. You know what the Bible says they were? They said they were worthless men. They said they were worthless men. You know, they'd go out when there's a sacrifice, like, oh, wow, I got the best part of the meat. And they would commit adultery. And they're just really terrible people. And remember what God told Eli about them. He said, and I declare to him, Eli, that I'm about to punish his house forever for the iniquity that he knew because his sons were blaspheming God and he did not restrain them. And so you had a couple things going on at this time. The leadership of Israel, they just weren't good people. Oh, yeah, they worshiped God, but they made God whatever they want him to be, right? They thought, this is okay. What I'm doing is fine. And the people, they worshiped the Baals and the Ashtaroth at this time. And so we're going to see how that plays out as we go through this story. And that didn't show up at all, so we won't go through that. All right, so let's get into 1 Samuel 4. So the people, they're getting in this battle with the Philistines, and they line up in a battle line against them, and they go into battle. And can someone tell me who wins this first battle? We're talking about in 1 Samuel 4. Ethan? The Philistines win. Well, that's not good. How many people of the Israelites die in this first battle? $30,000 in the first battle. 4,000 die in the first battle. Right, we're going to get there. Yeah, I'll call on you in a second. So the elders have a great idea. What's their great idea? We lost the first battle. What do we need to do? Let's carry our secret weapon. Now, God's kind of a secret weapon, right? Yeah. So they bring him, but, you know, it's kind of interesting. It's almost like they've got God in a box, and they'll, oh yeah, we need to bring the God, our God in a box with us, right? It's almost the way it seems they view it. Go ahead, Brian. There you go. Right. I think they did too, and we're going to see that play out here. So yes, they bring this ark of the covenant with them. And who carries it? Who are some of the priests that carry it? You said their names a minute ago. They're worthless men. Who are the priests that carried it? Hophni and Phinehas, right? Yeah, so these great guys, these worthless men who are operating as priests of God are carrying this Ark of the Covenant. Remember, God had already told Eli something bad is about to happen. It says that your ears are going to tingle when you hear it. And so they bring it in. And what do the people do when they bring the Ark of the Covenant into the camp? They shout. They're like, you know, they're like excited. We're going to win this thing. We got God here. We got our God with us. And then the Philistines hear about it, and look at what they say. A God has come into the camp. Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us. Who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague. All right, how many years after that God had struck the Egyptians was it roughly that they are saying this? Wait, remember the timeline. How long? It's at least 400 years. It's a long time, right? And they remember that God had done this to the Egyptians, just like God said they would remember, right? They're afraid. David, you said something? There you go, Sully. Yeah. Yeah. There's some recognition here that there's some power, and they think they come to camp. Now, what the Philistine says, like, all right, we got to still be men, right? That's what they say. Yeah, let's act like men, and let's still go into battle. And what happens? What happens? Bringing that Ark in the Covenant was it, right? That was the magic ticket, right? I've got God here. I brought him into the battle, and now we got it taken care of. Is that how it worked out? All right, Jeff, how many people died? 30,000 of the men of Israel died. Who else died? Hophni and Phinehas die, right? And then to heap shame on this whole thing, we'll come back to that, what else happened? Ark of the Covenant was taken, right? The Philistines stole their God. May have been a way to look at it. They looked at it. And Hophni and Phinehas died. So a man runs from the battle line. These guys must have been good runners at the time. So he runs from the battle line. He's got his clothes are torn. There's dirt on his head. And he runs up to Eli. Eli's 98 years old. He's fat. That's what the Bible says. And he's sitting on a bench. And the man tells him, look, your son's died, we've suffered defeat, and the Ark of the Covenant's been stolen. What happens to Eli? What happens to him then? He dies. How does he die? And he falls off the back. Now, if this was like, you know, one of your legends, you know, of the great hero Eli, which he was not, the Bible seems to indicate that in a lot of ways he was a good man. Would this be the way that he dies? Would this be what would happen. That's not the way I would read it, right? That's not the way I'd write it if I'm trying to build somebody up. This is a real story, right? This is a real account of what happened. And so he dies too. And his daughter-in-law, when she hears that her husband dies and the Ark of Covenant's taken, she's pregnant, and she goes into labor, and she has a baby. Anybody know what she names the baby? Go ahead. Ichabod. Yeah, not this guy. What does Ichabod mean? Anybody remember? Yeah, the glory has departed from Israel. It's probably why this guy was named that. He's kind of he's kind of silly in the story. But yeah, Ichabod, the glory has departed from Israel. That's how they viewed it. This is a really sad time for them. Now we're going to get to see how God interacts with the Philistines and their view of false gods. And this is kind of interesting. So God's power didn't show up to save the Israelites, did it? It didn't show up. They brought the Ark of the Covenant. It didn't show up there. But now God's power is going to show up here. And so they bring it, and they put the Ark of the Covenant in the temple with their God. Now, why would they do that? They're like, now we got two gods we can worship? Maybe. Yeah, it's maybe not special to them. It may also be they're saying, look, our God must be better than this God. We've taken him, and we've put him in our temple now next to this other idol. So what happens to the idol? The idol of Dagon. It falls and breaks. Yeah, the first time it falls over, and they're like, we'll set our God back up. Isn't that kind of funny? They've got to set the God back up because he's a statue of some sort. So they set him up. And then the next night he falls over, and they come back in, and his head and his arms are cut off. What is God saying there? I'm a real God. Right here, I'm real. And that thing you got over there, you made it. And that's all it is. It's fake. And he does something else. He sends mice and tumors on the people of Ashdod and its territory. And it's terrible. And I think a lot of people are dying, and they're getting tumors. And it's a terrifying thing. Some people have speculated that this might be the Black Plague, maybe. Because the Black Plague was typically, there's tumors, and it's, you know, associated with rats and that kind of thing. So it could be something like that. God terrifies them. So whenever something bad like that happens to you, what's your natural reaction? Let's go send it to my brothers and let them take care of it, right? So they send the Ark of the Covenant to Gath, and the same kind of thing happens, right? You get mice and tumors, and they're terrified. And so they decide they're going to send it over to Ekron. That's what we should do. We're going to send it to another one, and same kind of thing happens again. So we get into chapter 6, and the Philistines are going, okay, it's been here 7 months, and this is not working. And what are we going to do? Let's call our priests and diviners. And what do they suggest that they do? What's their suggestion? Yeah, there's some common sense here. Like, send it back. We don't need to hear anymore. All right. Look what they say, though. Isn't that kind of interesting? They knew that Pharaoh hardened his heart, and that didn't work out so well for him. They remembered what happened to the Egyptians. I don't know how they knew all about this. Maybe it's their interaction with the Israelites. There's some evidence that maybe the Philistines had attacked the Egyptians after the Israelites had kind of, or God had done all those things to them. So that may be why they heard stories from the Egyptians. I don't know. But they knew that with this God, if there's something like this happen, don't harden your heart, because it doesn't work out too well. I thought that was kind of interesting. That was their take on it. So how do they decide they're going to send it back? Two cows and a cart, right? They didn't, I think, remember the whole thing with the priests and the poles and all that, but they're just like, let's get rid of it. Now, there's something interesting. What kind of cows do they pick? I heard somebody over, milk cows, right? And what else about these cows is interesting? They never had a yoke put on them. All right, so I need like some actual farmers in here. not people that have seen a few things, but people that are actually have been around cows and farming to help out with this. But what would happen if you strap a cart to two cows that have never pulled a cart? Right. So to make matters worse, though, what else? What kind of cows are these? What was that? Yeah, they're milk cows, right? And what do they do with their calves? They take them away from them. Now, I don't know a lot about cows, but I've heard that if you don't milk a cow when it needs to be milked, it gets very ornery. So they shut these cows up at home, and they put two ornery cows together that have to pull together this cart that never pulled a cart before. Why did they do all that? Why didn't they like say, well, let's get some cows that are used to this and let's drive it back over to Beth Shemesh? Why did they do it this way? Maybe the other cows die off. Maybe there's some other plagues. I didn't think about that one. That was a good one, Noah. Go ahead, Sully. Why? It seems to me like a test, right? They're like, hey, we're going to know for sure that the issue was with us having the Ark of the Covenant here if these cows go straight back to Israel with it. Because there's no reason that that should happen. I mean, they should be tearing the cart up or running off in different directions. That's what should happen, right? All right, Herbert. I think that's a good point. Go ahead, Cheryl. Yep. And it says that they go along the road directly to Beth Shemesh, lowing all the way, right? Like they're just on a mission. So it's pretty obvious that God's behind it. So they rise in Beth Shemesh, and the people are excited, right? They offer a sacrifice to God. The cows didn't get the better end of that deal. But they offer a sacrifice to God, and then what do the men of Beth Shemesh decide to do? I don't know what possessed them to look inside the Ark of the Covenant. Apparently they've never seen Indiana Jones, but like they decide to look inside the Ark of the Covenant. And what happens to these 70 men? They die, right? Now, what in the law of Moses should have told them that that was a bad idea? It's not really their job to touch the thing, right? It's not their job to mess with that. And they are disobeying God. We learn that with Uzzah, right, later, when he's carrying it in a cart for David. So they say, we can't take care of this, and the ark is transported to Kiriath-Jearim, where Abinadab takes care of it for a long time. And it says that the people lamented after the Lord. So I think that's kind of interesting. There seems to be a little bit of a change of heart, that they're sad, that they're lamenting after the Lord. And that gets us into chapter 7. And one thing that it says about the people is that they worshiped the Baal and the Ashtoreth at this time. That was just part of their worship. It sounded like they also worshiped Jehovah as well. They just kind of decided that they would just adopt all of that. And they would worship these other gods, and they'd worship the Lord, and they'd kind of worship the Lord how they wanted to. And, you know, there's just, they did what was right in their own eyes. That's what was going on. And they come to Samuel, and Samuel says, guys, you got to put away those false gods. You've got to get yourself back in a right relationship with God, because that's what he wants. He's not like these other false gods that are not real and are whatever you want to make them. He is real, And he has expectations of righteousness and service only to him if you want to be in a right relationship with him. So he tells the people, put away those idols, and they do. They tear down the Baal and the Ashtaroth. They put them away, and he calls them all to Mizpah. So he calls them all to Mizpah, and the whole congregation comes into Mizpah. And they get there, and you know they're talking with Samuel, and the Philistines hear about it. And they decide it's a good time to attack. Why would it be a good time, if you're in the Philistine, why would it be a good time to attack the people at this point? What's that? They're all together, right? Yeah, their attention's distracted. They're all together. I mean, these people didn't necessarily, you know, live in a really tight bunch. I mean, there's some spread out through the country. They ended up, you know, with a lot of skirmishes in those kind of battles before. Gathering everybody together seemed like a pretty big opportunity for the Philistines, and so they decide to come and attack the Israelites. And what do the Israelites do? What's their reaction when they hear that the Philistines are coming? They were afraid, right? And what do they ask Samuel to do? Yeah, to pray to God. Now, what had they just done that really means that prayer might actually matter? What had they just done in the country? What did they just do? I'm hearing some rumbling. Somebody speak up. It's a big one. They what? They were mourning and praying, and what else did they do, though? They got rid of the false gods. They got their lives right, right? They turned around and decided to obey and serve the one true God. They tried to get that relationship back to where it needed to be. And so when they cry out to God this time, was it like what happened with when they brought the Ark of the Covenant into battle? What was different this time? What was different this time, some of the young'uns? What was different when they cried out to God? They cried out to the real God, yeah. But what did he do? I can't hear if somebody's speaking up. What did he do? He sent a loud thunder. And apparently it was loud enough to frighten the Philistines. And they got confused. And they started to fight. They started to fight each other. And the Israelites had their opportunity, right? And they chased the Philistines out of there. And they killed them. And they drove them out of their land. I'm going to ask you a question. What is an Ebenezer? That's a word we use a lot, right? I've got my Ebenezer back at the house. You know, I pull it out whenever I need it. Stone of help, you mean it's not this guy? It's not Ebenezer Scrooge. No, you're right. It's a stone of help. And so after they force the Philistines out, and with God's help, they do that, Samuel sets up a reminder. He puts up a stone of help, the Ebenezer, so that people would remember what he said here. Till now the Lord has helped us. So we see a theme here, right? We see a theme when it comes to worshiping the true God. First of all, you've got to have the right one, the one that actually has power, the one that's real. But is that enough? Is it enough to worship and worship the real God? Is that all that he requires? Okay, only him. Okay, well, that gets out a lot. But the people are like, hey, we got our God on in the Ark of the Covenant here. And we bring it into battle, and God doesn't offer any help for that. What was wrong? They didn't have the relationship. And why did they not have the relationship with God? Their actions. They were not obeying God. And so it took both, right? It said, okay, let me clear out all the false gods, but let me also worship God as he wants to be worshiped. I have to meet him on his standard of righteousness and ask for his forgiveness and be holy, and then I can expect help, and then I can expect his promises to be fulfilled. And that, I mean, he told the people of Israel that multiple times, right? I'm giving you all these promises as a physical nation. I'm going to defeat your enemies. We don't have necessarily that promise of our physical enemies will be defeated, but they did. But it was conditional. It was conditional on them having the right relationship with him, right? It was conditional on them obeying him and following his will. It wasn't just good enough for me to bring the power with me. It wasn't that kind of God. It was somebody that required a relationship. And I think the same thing applies to us. If you look at this, there's a lot of sadness in this story, right? There's a lot of sadness in this account. You got people like Eli didn't restrain his boys, and his boys turned out to be bad men. And those bad men were leading Israel, and Israel wasn't following God like they should have. They were worshiping false gods. There's a lot of bad things, a lot of sad things. But God wanted the relationship with them, and he allowed them, once they turned their lives around, once they got rid of all the sin, and once they got rid of what was separating them from God, he allowed that relationship to be rebuilt, and he was there to help them again. And so I think it's something for us to look at, too, as Christians, right? Is that, you know, it's like the statement that says, you know, if can we really expect God to be hearing our prayers if we've got sin in our lives? Can we really expect him to help us and keep his promises that he's offered some conditions around if we're not meeting those conditions, if we're not doing what he's asked us to do, if we don't have the right kind of relationship? Any comments on that? Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a really good point, Gloria, is that I think a lot of times when we worship false gods, or in the sense of, you know, maybe it's money or our jobs, or maybe it's a sports personality, or when we want God to meet us on our level of morality rather than us meeting him on his level, is that really we're trying to straddle a fence. We're trying to be enough like the world around us that we don't look too different. That's a good point. There he is. If you'll, yep. Well, I appreciate. Go ahead. I got two more. Go ahead, Brian, and then Landon. Yeah, that's a good point. All right, we'll get Landon, and then I think we'll be done.